Hi, Nation listeners. It's Derek from American Prestige. I'm about to be joined by Esfandiar Batman Galij from Bourse and Bazaar for a conversation about the economic repercussions of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. But I just wanted to let you know that you can find more of our coverage of the war on our feed over at AmericanPrestigePod.com or on the podcast app of your choice. Thanks for listening.
That's kind of conversation between the soul.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am very pleased to welcome back to the show Esfandiar Batman Galij. He is a returning guest. He is founder of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, also professor at Johns Hopkins, and he has a piece in foreign policy that just came out this week. The Iran war is jeopardizing the entire global economy. Obviously, we are going to be talking about the Iran war here. Esfandiar, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Good to be back there.
So before we get really into the focus of your piece, which is on the economic impacts of this conflict, you've been watching very closely as things have unfolded over what is now a full week since this war began, as this is airing. Just generally, what you've observed, kind of your takeaways as to... where this conflict is and where it might be heading?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's an opportunity to reflect a little bit on where some of my predictions might have been wrong. I gave a briefing maybe a week before the war started to a team at a international oil company. And, you know, the sort of default position I had was that Iran would respond by to an Israeli or U.S. attack by targeting commercial shipping. And I expected that there would be attacks on vessels in the Persian Gulf in order to change kind of the risk appetite of international shipping companies, including companies that are involved in moving oil out of the Persian Gulf to global markets. But ultimately, what we've seen is something that was a lot broader than that and represented Iran retaliating in a much more significant way, much more quickly, by not only trying to hit U.S. bases in the region, but actually the really striking thing has been the willingness of Iran to target civilian infrastructure across the Gulf. So we've seen airports and refineries and hotels and power plants targeted in different places, with the UAE being the country that's been targeted the most. And, you know, the piece that I wrote for Foreign Policy was about trying to understand what that escalation means for the global economy. That piece came out a few days ago. And, you know, we're seeing each day additional reports about disruptions in the oil sector, in exports of fertilizers, in global aviation, and it just seems to all be sort of accumulating. And it comes back to this, I think, move on the Iranian side, which was to sort of externalize this war very quickly and impose as much cost as possible very quickly.
Do you get the sense that the U.S. was at all prepared for this? My sense is that Donald Trump thought this would be over in 48 hours. With the Iranian Delcy Rodriguez in power. And he's kind of flummoxed at this point. And part of that comes from just the fact that the Iranians haven't surrendered, but maybe part of it comes from the way that they've responded by, as you say, striking the Gulf so heavily. I mean, it was expected that they would attack U.S. bases in the Gulf states, but that they've gone so much deeper than that. And really made that the focus, I would say, even more so than trying to strike at Israel. This has been the focus of their retaliation. Do you think that's caught the Trump administration on the back foot?
I mean, I think it has. And the way we can sort of demonstrate that is that the administration has been unable to reassure global markets about the possible spillover effects from the war. So we've seen Secretary of State Rubio come out and say that they're going to take steps to ensure that the oil exports can sort of continue. that they've announced basically that they're going to use DFI, which is a sort of development finance institution of the U.S. government, to provide some kind of insurance product to global shipping. They've also talked about potentially providing naval escorts for tankers to get the movement of oil back through the Gulf. But these are very reactive and sort of piecemeal solutions for a problem.
And dangerous. I mean, putting U.S. naval vessels in the Strait of Hormuz is dangerous. I mean, you could see, you know, Iranians firing on those vessels with, you know, I think fairly advanced anti-ship weaponry that they're deliberately at this point trying to stay out of the range of. So that's inviting something, you know, it's inviting a catastrophe, it seems like.
I mean, you know, the force posture that would be necessary for the U.S. to really secure maritime shipping in the Persian Gulf, which is this incredibly congested body of water, is, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. It's going to take a lot of naval assets to do that. And I think the U.S. will struggle, and it will be relatively easy for Iran to, like, sort of continually menace the shipping. The other thing to highlight here is that if we are in a situation where the U.S. sort of takes it upon itself to try and maintain these flows through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran's challenge is not to keep up the frequency of attacks. The challenge for Iran is if it can maintain the capacity to sporadically attack, but to make those attacks kind of consequential enough that it continues to basically keep the risk calculation such that the U.S. has to be there reassuring tankers that it's going to protect them. So you don't need to hit, you know, 20 ships a day in order for this to be a big deal for the global economy. You just have to have a reasonable capacity to hit a ship whenever you want and to sort of prove that capacity through these sporadic attacks. And I think this is the, you know, in some ways, the operation that the U.S. is toying with can become a kind of interminable, a kind of permanent almost position. And the parallel that we can draw is to the Red Sea crisis, where the Houthis kind of were able to, for a period of 2 years, significantly disrupt global shipping and reduce the number of vessels that were going through the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal. You know, it's not inconceivable for Iran to do something similar. And we're seeing signs of that already. So I do think the administration was, you know, very much kind of had failed to anticipate a lot of these potential effects. And I imagine that is a source of great frustration for leaders in the Gulf, who are, of course, very angry at Iran for the fact that they're being targeted, but at the same time are probably incredibly frustrated with the U.S. for not anticipating some of these consequences.
Do you get the sense that we're seeing already any divergence in what Israel wants out of this war and what the U.S. wants out of this war? Because it feels like you're pulling in two different directions to some degree, and it's only going to get worse the longer this goes on. That the Israeli interest is really in just smashing Iran, and the consequences, whatever, who cares? It's not our problem. But the U.S. has interests in maintaining consistent energy flows, consistent shipping out of the Gulf, in propping up the Gulf states for reasons that we can get into in more detail. But it feels like this is not, we're not operating on the same page necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's a fair sort of summary. I think the difference is that Israel does have a strategy. I think the way you put it is right. I mean, the strategy is basically to push Iran towards something like a failed state scenario. We often hear that, you know, Israel might be interested in regime change, or that the U.S. might be interested in regime change. I'm a little bit skeptical of that framing, because I think that regime change almost presupposes that the U.S. and Israel are willing to take on the responsibility of actually installing a new regime, and in a sense being responsible for the aftermath of the war and kind of the prospects for Iran moving forward. On the U.S. side, I definitely don't think that's what Israel is interested in. You know, from a purely sort of balance of power perspective, you know, there's no reason for Israel to have a strong Iran. You know, it wants the operational freedom of being really the only hegemonic power in the Middle East, then it is well on its way to achieving that status. I think the last country that sort of stands between it and total dominance of the region is Turkey. But on the U.S. side, I think it's a little bit more complicated because we are getting mixed messages. You know, again, Rubio is briefing folks in Washington and also leaders in the Gulf that this is not a regime change war, that, you know, they're not trying to install a new leadership in Iran. But at the same time, Trump is insisting in different interviews and on, you know, posting on social media that he wants to have a say in who the new leaders are in the country, which is maybe something closer to a Venezuela.
Right. I mean, he even said it. He said, like with Delcy, I mean, this was what he told Axios, I think. I need to pick the next leader like I did with Delcy. Yeah. So a week into this, he's still clinging to this idea that he can do Venezuelan style regime change on the cheap. And yeah, I just don't think, particularly that scenario, I don't think the Israelis have any interest in a situation where you get like somebody plucked out of this government, whether it's, you know, somebody like Ali Larijani or you know, whoever, and put in charge. Like, I just don't see that being, the Israelis being satisfied with that.
I mean, the game for the Israelis doesn't end after this war. And even if Trump manages or decides that, you know, he's succeeded, he's killed the supreme leader, he's sunk all the ships in the Iranian Navy, he's devastated the country, he's shown his mettle as a wartime president. If he decides that and there is a ceasefire and the Iranians are able to sort of pragmatically, and there's a big question mark around that, but let's say that the authorities in the Islamic Republic pragmatically decide to let Trump position this as his victory to an extent on the basis that they get to also position themselves as quote unquote the new leadership that he gets to deal with in a sort of Delcy style scenario, thereby maintaining the existence or the continuation of the Islamic Republic. I think for the Israelis in that scenario, they're just going to continue what has been a very long campaign of undermining Iranian sovereignty, you know, the integrity of the state, the functionality of Iran's security establishment. And so what you can imagine is a outcome where Trump thinks he's achieved the ceasefire. He thinks that he has a leadership he can work with, but behind the scenes, Israel is going to be continuing as a sort of spoiler. And in a way, if that happens, it will be a kind of redux of what happened during the Obama administration, where Obama was able to secure a deal with the authorities in the Islamic Republic that was very much tied to a certain kind of leader in the Islamic Republic acting more pragmatically, trying to steer that system in a direction where it had a less antagonistic relationship with the United States. And in the background, Israel was, you know, basically very effectively putting the groundwork in place to make sure that that deal fell apart and that, you know, they could continue to push Iran towards the crisis that we see now. So in a sense, I can imagine a situation where Israel does to Trump basically what it did to Obama, which is to undermine the ability of the U.S. to independently decide what its Iran policy is going to look like, even if in the aftermath of the war that everyone has sort of long expected that the U.S. and Iran might fight.
So I want to get into your piece and the economic fallout, both short-term and long-term, but maybe we should start with just sort of a primer. As you say in the piece, the Gulf states have become not just, you know, the economic hub of the Middle East, they've become major players globally, economically speaking. I don't know the extent to which it's still true that Americans, you know, think about Saudi Arabia and think about oil, or, you know, the Gulf in general and just think about oil, but that's not the case anymore. So maybe you could just sort of start by talking about how embedded these countries have become, in how the global economy works.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been traveling to the Gulf since, I think, 2006, 2007. And it's been really remarkable to see the changes in all of the GCC states. I mean, especially the UAE, but Qatar and more recently in Saudi Arabia. And I think it's true that I think most people now who follow kind of world events have an understanding that the Gulf is no longer just about oil. And part of that is because we see these pictures of these, you know, gleaming cities with their skyscrapers, and we, you know, read about all the hotels and the things that are a little bit of a meme when it comes to what a Gulf city looks like and what's happening there. But alongside that is a sort of economic reality that I think remains underappreciated, including by policymakers in Washington, which is that the infrastructure that has been developed in the Gulf outside of oil infrastructure, so logistical infrastructure and also petrochemical infrastructure, some manufacturing, and the infrastructure related to aviation that's not just about tourism, you know, these are basically systems that have made the Gulf a hub for the global economy. And one of the claims I make in the foreign policy piece, which I think, you know, clarifies this and where we are right now, is that this is basically the first war since the Second World War that is directly impacting cities that we can consider hubs in the global economy. You know, the U.S. has fought a lot of wars since World War II, you know, in Korea and Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq, but none of those wars had direct spillover effects on a city like Dubai or a city like Doha or infrastructures like the refineries or the ports that are now being hit by Iranian attacks. And the consequence for the global economy means that, you know, everyone's paying attention to basically the oil price and the energy exports. But one of the things that is becoming clear is that there are many other kind of areas in which these disruptions in the Gulf will make themselves felt. So to give you a couple examples, in the area of logistics, you know, 10% of global air freight basically passes through the airports in Dubai and in Doha. So rerouting all of that air freight that is kind of intercontinental and connecting economies in Africa to Asia to Europe, that's like an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. And if it is done, is going to add significant costs for the movement of those goods. Similarly, the port of Jebel Ali, which is in Dubai, is one of the sort of 10 most important ports in the world in terms of its throughput, how much cargo it handles in a year. And it's a port that's not just important for the Gulf. It's, in a sense, the most important port for Central Asia, for East Africa, for South Asia. And it's the port that connects the major economies in Europe and in China to these more developing regions. And goods come to Jebel Ali, and then they get basically directed through feeder services through smaller ports or taken by train once they've arrived in smaller ports to other countries. And so when we talk about the impacts of this conflict, I mean, you know, if you're a manufacturer in East Africa and you need to purchase a piece of equipment for your factory, that equipment is probably going to be Chinese these days, and it's probably going to get to you by coming first to Jebel Ali in the UAE and then getting redirected to the closest port to you, maybe, you know, Mombasa or Djibouti or something like that. And so to the extent that no container traffic can make it to Jebel Ali, and then get redirected. I mean, these are huge effects for supply chains. And it's, you know, I think the granular impacts here about how economic functions happen in developing economies in Africa, South Asia, you know, those sorts of things, they're far away from the headlines in a sense right now, but it's very consequential for a lot of countries out there.
And not to, you know, be cliche about this, but there is also an energy concern here. The Iranians have hit energy sites. There's a lot of gas production that goes on in the Gulf. There's a lot of oil production that goes on in the Gulf and the transits through the Strait of Hormuz. When you wrote your piece, I think you said that the price shock in terms of oil and gas has been modest. It's still modest, although it's gone up a fair amount, even since your piece came out. Yeah. We're at like $90 a barrel at this point for most oil packages and probably a few days away from $100 a barrel plus. Can you talk a little bit about what that means in terms of the global economy? We've already got the Trump administration issuing waivers to India to buy Russian oil, which was something that was so heinous that we had to put 50% tariffs on Indian products a few months ago. Now we're encouraging them to buy Russian oil to keep Russian oil on the market. Like it's really topsy-turvy at this point.
I mean, that's another example of the administration being totally reactive and not
just flat-footed, right? Yeah, like not planning just, for this. Yeah.
I mean, obviously we can talk about energy. It is the biggest story. And there's an oil analyst whom I respect and I think has a really good handle on the markets. And, you know, he's basically looking at this and saying that given the extent of the supply shock, if this doesn't get sort of addressed in some, you know, if the volumes coming out of the Persian Gulf don't increase relatively soon, it's possible for oil to reach $150 a barrel. And the reason for this is interesting. It's not that Iran has struck upstream infrastructure very much. It's, you know, Iran is not interfering with the production of oil. It is interfering with the movement of oil. And the consequence of that is that if countries like Iraq, UAE, even Iran itself cannot export their oil to their customers. You can't just turn off an oil well. It has a pressure and it produces oil and that oil has to go somewhere. And typically when there is a slowdown in exports, you put oil in storage to compensate. Where we are now is that the slowdown in exports is so dramatic that the storage is rapidly filling up. And there are countries in the region that don't have very much storage, for example, Iraq. And that is what will force a slowdown in production, which is itself a big problem for oil engineers and the productivity of these fields long-term. You know, if you turn down the production, it's not like you can just turn it back up overnight. But in the interim, the impact that we see is that, you know, the oil price is going to rise because it's not going to be easy for other producers to compensate for the amount of oil exports that are being lost through the Strait of Hormuz. So that's an emerging problem. And then there's a kind of related issue around petrochemicals exports. So looking downstream, there have been some attacks on refineries making fuel products. There have also been attacks on LNG infrastructure that will impact the exports there. LNG tankers are not leaving through the Strait of Hormuz. But when we say petrochemical products, it's also worth noting that among those products is fertilizer. And one of the concerns that's been raised in a lot of circles is that this is exactly the period in which you're sowing in the Northern Hemisphere for the harvest that will happen in the fall. And if farmers are unable to get the fertilizer they need in order to basically sow these crops, that could have a knock-on effect on crop yields down the line. So this is also something that people are watching. All of this suggests to me that, you know, at some point it will, the amount of pain that's being sort of inflicted by this war will be intolerable for the different parties involved, including the United States. And And this leads to kind of the question of, well, what's the solution to the fact that Iran struck all of this infrastructure and was able to use some ballistic missiles and drones to kind of put the global economy into disarray? There is an argument that Iran has demonstrated a capacity that needs to be dealt with definitively. So you know, the Gulf states, the US, Israel need to go in and just take out the Iran threat once and for all, because you can't be held hostage by this kind of ability to interrupt global trade through the strait. The problem with that argument is that the military solution to the threat that Iran is posing through these asymmetric attacks necessarily means an operation that's going to be months in duration at a minimum. And if the pain is already intolerable, you know, I think it's very difficult to imagine that Gulf states are going to say, look, we're going to just basically go through this pain for another 6 months in order to get rid of this threat forever. And so I do think that the economic situation ultimately is conducive to the countries involved pushing for some kind of ceasefire.
It's particularly the case when I don't think we've seen everything that Iran could do to the Gulf states. I mean, if the conflict goes on for months, you're probably going to see a widening even beyond what we've already seen of the target packages, right? What in your mind is sort of, you know, what could be the worst case scenario here? I mean, I've seen people talk about, you know, the Iranians targeting desalination plants.
Yeah.
You know, there are other vulnerable things that get at not just economic activity, but could create a real humanitarian catastrophe in countries that just, I mean, you would never have imagined, like, there being a humanitarian catastrophe in Dubai or you know, in that sense. And it's but that potential exists, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I think we should emphasize that I think that that Iran's strategy to target civilian infrastructure is fundamentally illegitimate and is difficult to justify. It may have been rational given the nature of the threat that they were facing from Israel and the US, but ultimately, you know, they have done something that is similarly illegal as the US military operation itself. Now, the other factor here is that, of course, there are mutual dependencies in the region, both politically and economically. So Iran is also very dependent on the UAE economically for bilateral trade and for access to the global banking system. And so by targeting the UAE, it is jeopardizing its own economic viability. If Iranian leaders care at all about having a sort of normally functioning economy at some stage, they will need
to reengage. But if you weigh that against, this is an existential conflict and we're all going to die at the end of it if we lose, which I think is the calculation that it needs to be at least in the back of the mind of people in that government. Like, you know, a normally functioning economy is going to take second place, right?
Yeah, well, but here's the thing. I think their view is that this could become an existential conflict.
Right, but that's what I'm talking about, though. If this goes on for months and it really starts to look like there's other end to this,
then they can go scorched earth, and that's definitely a possibility. But for now, you know, basically, I guess what I'm getting at is that the Iranian approach was more escalatory and more extreme than I expected. But if you look at it from the Iranian perspective, it can still be construed as a calibrated response.
Right.
They're adding a lot of pressure onto the Gulf. They're showing that they have this capability to go scorched earth, but they're still basically leaving enough space where everyone is feeling the pain, but thinking like, let's find an off-ramp here. And ultimately, the Gulf states, having not sort of jumped to taking a more proactive role within kind of fighting back and joining kind of US operations and giving their airspace and even deploying their own forces on a more offensive basis, I think that is an indication that at least at this stage, they're continuing to prefer finding some sort of negotiated solution here. But it's going to be incredibly difficult to rebuild trust between the parties and to figure out how you account for the central problem of this crisis, which is that the Gulf countries were dependent on the US as a security guarantor and as the architect of, like, basically the security framework for the region. They hosted US bases. What they maybe had not anticipated was that it would be the US that might trigger the war that would expose them to this kind of blowback, and that the US would be unable to protect them from the blowback of its own war of choice. And so navigating that in some ways is incredibly complex politically. And so what, at a minimum, what we're looking at is, you know, a ceasefire to let things just kind of stabilize economically. But it will take many months and I think quite complex diplomacy, which is not the strong suit of this U.S. administration, to rebuild the kind of trust that addresses this problem.
So I want to talk more about that. I have a couple of questions about if anything's been really broken long term here. But the first question I have, kind of following from, you know, the lingering question of whether Iran can inflict enough pain to force the Gulf states to pressure Trump, like, this hasn't worked yet, is I guess where I'm going to start with. Like, we saw the Gulf states lobbying publicly against this war before it even started, and it didn't have any effect. They're presumably not happy with how it's going so far, and yet it's continuing. There's no indication that they're having any impact on changing the administration's mind on what's going on. But is there a point? What are the pressure points, I guess, is what I'm asking. If it really gets serious and the Gulf states really say, like, this is intolerable, there's a lot of Gulf investment in the U.S. economy. We've already seen, you know, some vague mentions of the Gulf states reevaluating their foreign investment portfolios, thinking ahead to, like, we have to rebuild. You know, we're going to need to find, you know, ways to come back from this, and maybe some of the foreign investment has to get cut. Are there levers that haven't been pulled yet that could be pulled that would probably break the U.S. Gulf relationship in fundamental ways, but that could really put the Trump administration in a difficult situation in terms of, like, wrap this up?
It's a good question. You know, my view here is that when it comes to acute moments of crisis like this with this administration, and we saw this to an extent last June, if we talk about leverage, or if we talk about what the Gulf could do to convince Trump, it's not going to be an appeal to, like, I don't even think the oil price really matters that significantly. I mean, because it's not the kind of thing that Trump is going to feel politically until we're much closer to the midterms. You know, what matters here is the ability of certain people to get on the phone to Trump and sway him through basically personal appeals. I mean, you know, in a sense, the way that the US is operating right now, it is as though we have a monarchy, and this is a war that was started on the whims of a king. I would call the king actually Netanyahu, and then, you know, basically, like, instructing his vassal to join him in the conflict. But nonetheless, the point here is that to the extent that Trump might pull back, someone has to appeal to him personally. And I think that's where the Gulf is probably trying to find the right interlocutors and the right arguments to sway Trump, but also at the same time to make sure that the figures around Trump reinforce whatever message that he's given in that personal phone call. So you have to get Rubio on board. You have to get Hegseth on board. You know, you have to basically make sure that you don't have spoilers within coming into the Oval Office and just getting Trump to change his mind after 30 minutes because he can't hold on to a thought long enough in order to commit to a policy. And I mean, it seems sort of absurd to describe it in these terms, but I think...
But it's true. Yeah, I mean, this is how he operates.
I think there's some truth to this. And you know, I've had conversations with Gulf officials. I remember conversations last May when it was sort of clear that we might end up with a war where Gulf officials were, you know, we were in a meeting thinking about a sort of track 1.5 meeting, thinking about policy, you know, what it would look like to get a workable deal for the US and Iran during the negotiations. And the conversation was really about who should call Trump? Can someone broker a phone call between the Iranian president and Trump? And can we make that phone call positive enough so that Trump tweets right after it, so that that post on Truth Social or whatever becomes the policy of the US government, locks him in. Exactly. And that was literally the conversation with senior officials from the Gulf. And it's absurd, but and unfortunately it didn't happen, and we got the war, and then it didn't happen after, and then we got this worse war. But I still think that modality ends up being a key part of the story of how we get out of this. You just
have the ambassador in the Oval Office with a phone, like, here, Mr. President, make the post right
now.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's that is essentially what happened with the phone call that Netanyahu had to make to the Qataris after the strike. It's sort of the inverse of that, but you know. This is the nature of what we're dealing with. And unfortunately, the global economy, you know, the lives of Iranian civilians, the safety of citizens and expatriate workers in the Gulf, all of that is at stake while we sort of wait to see if this resolves. And, you know, that is such an indictment of the machinery of US policymaking and war fighting. Like, if that is where we are, then, you know, it is on the verge of irredeemable. And I think that's something that has just not been reckoned with. This is, you know, we've had conversations for a long time in the US about getting into wars on manufactured consent and by mistake and wars of choice. And then it becomes a forever war. Like, this is the epitome of a war of choice that was done with no strategic consideration that is having a global impact. And it may not have the same impact as the war in Iraq in terms of devastation in Iran. I certainly hope not. Or a toll for the US. But it's kind of like a death by a thousand cuts situation. The pain inflicted on so many people in so many small ways in this kind of global system that's connected to the Gulf, in some ways makes this war very consequential, or more consequential, especially if it ends up continuing for a period of months or longer.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
So, thinking about, again, things that might be broken permanently here. You started to talk about the U.S. Gulf relationship, and I want to talk a bit more about that, because if there is a conclusion at the end of this that throwing in with the U.S., hosting U.S. military bases, relying on the U.S. as a security guarantor, has failed the Gulf states, what does that look like in terms of what the U.S. Gulf relationship is going to be like? Did the Gulf states look elsewhere? Did they start, you know, dealing with China in a more direct way? Does China even want to get involved in this part of the world, which I have my doubts, at least to that extent? Certainly they want to be involved economically and maybe sell weapons, but do they really want to be providing security guarantees? I doubt it, having seen what it's done for the U.S. Like, what kind of security architecture could we be looking at in the Gulf, I guess, if there's a real change here?
It's interesting because there's been a debate about this for a long time, actually, with regard to the Gulf's relationship with Iran. And one of the things that Iranian officials have put on the table repeatedly with the Gulf states is basically to say, look, we don't have a problem with you. We have a problem with the fact that you are hosting U.S. bases that allow the U.S. to pose this threat to us that we cannot answer except for these asymmetric capabilities like our ballistic missiles or our support for proxies. And the pitch to the Gulf states was, look, basically, why don't you roll back your dependence on the U.S.? Iran had set out the goal of trying to get the U.S. out from the region, which didn't mean defeating the U.S. militarily. It meant things like what we saw in Iraq, which is the drawdown of U.S. forces so that you don't have as pronounced the footprint for the U.S. military in the region. And the view was that because the American public had gotten tired from this interventionism and this kind of like American empire, that maybe the tides were turning and the U.S. would sort of pivot away from the Middle East, and this would open space for Iran and the Gulf states to come up with a new regional security architecture where they were basically addressing their mutual threat perceptions in a direct way and not relying, the Gulf was no longer relying on the U.S. to kind of counterbalance Iran. That process essentially hit a wall because the U.S., while it was trying to sort of pull out from the region, kind of failed to take advantage of the opportunity presented by better ties between the Gulf and Iran by believing that the way to account for its own pullback was to position Israel as a partner for the Gulf in a more significant way. And so this was the logic of the Abraham Accords, the idea that you could basically help address the problem of an unbridled Iran by actually building a stronger relationship between Israel and the Gulf. And the reality is that although the UAE in particular has built, I think, a quite deep relationship with Israel, other Gulf states were very hesitant about deepening security partnership, especially in the aftermath of the genocide in Gaza. Saudi Arabia has ruled out normalization with Israel. There is a theory that this war with Iran and the impact on Saudi Arabia would change Saudi perspectives on that. I mean, just based on what I'm seeing in the commentary about Saudi Arabia, I think that still seems unlikely. But it's very difficult to imagine how we get out of this spiraling situation, because even if the Gulf states decide that they want to rethink their dependence on the U.S., they can't kick the U.S. out of the bases. And it wouldn't even be wise to do that because they don't have independent defense capabilities that would, compensate for the lack of U.S. support. So it has to be much more gradual. And in that context, the insistence of the U.S. to include regional issues in a deal with Iran is not something that Iran can or should reject on face. Because in a way, now that they have fought a war or they are fighting a war, it is somehow appropriate politically to discuss these security issues that go beyond the nuclear file in a way that it was not before the war. And so I see this as a little bit of a silver lining. It's like, prior to the war, given that the notion of negotiations was about a new nuclear deal to rectify the fact that Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018, it was reasonable for Iran to reject the insistence of U.S. negotiators that they talk about these other issues that go beyond the framework of the original nuclear deal. But now that they fought a war, the scope of that ceasefire and the agreement that might follow the ceasefire about that would sort of set out principles for U.S.-Iran relations can reasonably include these broader issues because the two sides have basically punched one another and, this is a fist fight now. And so you can talk about, how you're not going to have a fist fight again, not just talk about the nuclear issue as this like technical sort of package of disagreements. So that's maybe the issue here. And there's an opportunity for the Gulf states to also be at the table. But, the trust factor is going to be the big one. And just there will be a lot of anger and mutual resentment, and overcoming that will also be quite difficult.
My other question, thinking long term, like beyond this war, is how much damage has already been done or could be done if this goes on for several months to the, I want to put this euphemistically, as the Dubai system. Doesn't just apply to Dubai. It applies to Riyadh, Doha, yeah, Abu Dhabi to a lesser extent. But these cities that, as part of the, like, looking ahead to what do we do in the post-oil world to remain economically viable, have made themselves hubs of business, hubs for finance. In Dubai's case, increasingly trying to attract influencers to hype up the Dubai lifestyle. All of these things are predicated on, we're an oasis of calm, safe, you know, safety, where you can do business here and not worry about anything. There's nothing. I've already seen, you know, Instagram videos of influencers who were living in Dubai leaving and being like, I'm never coming back here. Like, it's not worth it. I'm dodging bombs. This is no good. Like, how much damage has already been done to that image? But if this goes on for, you know, 2, 4, 6 months,
yeah,
what could we be looking like and looking at in terms of that, just that image of the Gulf as an oasis, yeah, you know, being decimated?
I mean, I think there are always more influencers, so you know, you can always throw.
Yeah, I'm sort of just using that.
I know. But I think, but I mean,
catchy example,
but actually, Derek, I mean, I'm not saying that to be to sort of criticize the point. I'm saying that, like, I don't think it would be that difficult, actually, for the Gulf to, like, restore the superficial parts of its economic model. You know, the big conferences, yeah, the tourism, and all of that, yeah, stuff. You know, that in a way can, if this war doesn't actually devastate all of that infrastructure, which I think is unlikely, you know, you can imagine it as a kind of like natural disaster that then fades from memory and people start to go back. But when we talk about the willingness, let's put it this way. The thing that really underpins the economies of the region and has driven the development in the last sort of 20 years in particular is the willingness to allocate capital with a long-term view. And the Gulf has gotten to this stage of development mainly by relying on its own capital. But it is increasingly dependent on bringing in more capital from outside because the scale of the projects it's trying to undertake and the technology and the expense associated with those projects is greater than anything before it. So, you know, you see this attempt from the UAE, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia to actually position themselves as destinations for foreign investment in a lot of critical sectors. Here's where the challenge is, because if you're trying to make a bet on AI or on a big, you know, petrochemical plant or on some kind of green infrastructure, and your investment horizon is like your return on investment is 10 years from when you break ground. The ability of you to have confidence that you're not going to end up with a war like this at some point within the next 10 years, that's where it becomes very difficult. And ultimately, the resolution of this conflict has to be clear enough and decisive enough if the Gulf is going to bounce back. If the Gulf's developmental trajectory is not going to be shifted, the end of this conflict has to be decisive enough so that you can make those long-term bets again. And that's where I see the risk. It's, you know, a lot of this superficial stuff will bounce back, but these long-term decisions, you know, and it's not that it will go to zero. People will still make long-term bets on the Gulf. But, you know, it's that 10th project that could have been there, but maybe isn't there because that 10th investor, you know, decided that actually this is not for us. We can't bet on this region. We're going to go elsewhere. So you're always going to be undershooting the potential that you had prior to the conflict unless you really manage to restore confidence and sort of bounce back in a stronger position.
Last question. I'm not going to ask you to predict, but what are the things that you're going to be watching if we're back here having the same conversation 2 months from now, 4 months from now, 6 months from now, as the, you know, the Pentagon's planning for September at this point, according to Politico. What are the things you're going to be looking for the longer this thing goes on, from the standpoint of the economic aspects and their ramifications?
Yeah. So it goes back to your point about, you know, when this starts to tip into a potentially existential threat for the regime, where we're talking about more than just leaders being killed, but, you know, the very capability of the Islamic Republic to sort of have control over Iran is in threat. The issue I see there is if the US decides that it needs to like definitively hobble the regime, there will be a very strong temptation for the US to start to hit more civilian infrastructure in Iran, power plants, water systems, things of that nature, which would be much more akin to how they approached the air wars in Iraq in 2003 and in 1991. They've so far kind of held off on that, suggesting that they want to keep some basic functionality in Iran. You know, the Iran's supply chains and stores and things and the banking system, and it's all still kind of working under the war conditions. If the US starts to hit that infrastructure, or if Israel starts to hit that infrastructure because they have more operational freedom and fewer scruples, then, you know, basically we end up in a situation where not only does the regime feel that it's in this greater sort of facing an existential threat, but it also will feel it has more justification to hit similar infrastructure in the Gulf, desalination plants, power plants, and so forth. And that's where we're in truly uncharted territory, and that's where it becomes much harder to imagine the bounce back, both because of like the psychological effect, but also just very practically. If you knock out like a thermal power plant today and you destroy the turbines in it, you know, there's a global shortage of those turbines, and it's going to take you like, there's like a 5-year backlog. There's a backlog of transformers. There's a backlog of, you know, all number of kinds of industrial machinery. And the point being that reconstruction, you know, becomes a very big challenge, not only for Iran, but for the wider region, if we start to see those sorts of tit-for-tat attacks on more essential civilian infrastructure. So I think the thing that I'm watching in terms of the acceleration of this crisis, but also the long-term impacts, is whether we start to tip into a scenario where a different category of infrastructure is starting to be hit. And if that's the case, then, you know, then we're in for a much sort of a darker period, basically.
Well, we like to end on dark notes on this show. So, Yar, we really do appreciate your time and having you on. And obviously, we'll have links to your piece of foreign policy. We'll have links to Borsan Bazaar in the show notes for folks to find your work. Thanks again. And I have a feeling we'll be back here before too long to continue this conversation.
Thanks, Derek. Hopefully someone can, you know, hold up their speaker to the phone and play this episode for Trump, and then he can decide to do something else.
Make sure you have the Truth Social window open. Yeah, so he has to lock it in. That's the way to go. But
I think I made that joke the last time we spoke, actually, that Trump should listen to this program. So that's my
advice, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you,
Derek.
Next.